by the sea 1887. I. On the southeastern coast of Massachusetts is a small village with which I was once familiarly acquainted. It differs little in its general aspect from other hamlets scattered along that shore. It has its one long, straggling street, plain and homelike, from which at two or three different points a winding lane leads off and ends abruptly in the water. 50 years ago the village had a business activity of its own. There still remain the vestiges of a wharf at a point where once was a hammering shipyard. Here and there, in bare fields along the sea, are the ruins of vats and windmills, picturesque remains of ancient salt works. There is no visible sign left now of the noisy life of the shipyards, except a marble stone beneath a willow in the burying ground on the hill, which laments the untimely death of a youth of 19, killed in 1830 in the launching of a brig. But traces of the salt works everywhere remain, in frequent sheds and small barns which are wet and dry, as the saying is, all the time, and will not hold paint. They are built of salt boards. There were a good many of the people of the village and its adjoining country who interested me very greatly. I am going to tell you a simple event which happened in one of its families, deeply affecting its little history. James Parsons was a man perhaps 60 years of age, strongly built, gray-haired, clean-shaven except for the conventional seaman's fringe of beard below the chin, and always exquisitely neat. Whether you met him in his best suit, on Sunday morning, or in his old clothes, going to his oyster beds or his cranberry marsh, it was always the same. He was usually in his shirt sleeves in summer. His white cotton shirt, with its easy collar and wristbands, seemed always to have just come from the ironing board. "It ain't no trouble at all to keep James clean," I have heard Mrs. Parsons say, in her funny little way. "He picks his way round for all the world just like a pussycat, and never gets no spots on him, nowhere." You saw at once, upon the slightest acquaintance with James, that while he was of the same general civilization as his neighbors, he was of a different type. In his narrowness, there was a peculiar breadth and vigor which characterized him. He had about him the atmosphere of a wider ocean. His early reminiscences were all of that picturesque and adventurous life which prevailed along our coast to within 40 years, and his conversation was suggestive of it. He held a silver medal from the Humane Society for conspicuous bravery in the rescue of the crew of a ship stranded in winter in a storm of sleet off Post Hill Bar. He had a war hatchet, for which he had negotiated face to face with a naked cannibal in the South Sea. He was familiar with the Hoogly. His language savored always of the sea. His hands turned in, at night. He was full of sayings and formulas of a maritime nature. There was one which always seemed to me to have something of a weird and mystic character: "South moon brings high water on coast island bar." In describing the transactions of domestic life, he used words more properly applicable to the movements of large ships. He would speak of a saucepan as if it weighed 100 tons. He never tossed or threw even the slightest object, he hove it. "Why, father," said Mrs. Parsons, surprised at seeing him for a moment untidy, "what have you been doing? Your boots and trousers legs is all white." "Yes," said Mr. Parsons, apologetically, looking down upon his dusty garments, "I just took that bucket of ashes and hove 'em into the henhouse." The word "heave," in fact, was always upon his tongue. It applied to everything. "How was this road straightened out?" I asked him one day. "Did the town vote to do it?" "No, no," he said quickly, "there was never no vote. The selectmen just come along one day, and got us all together, and hove in and hove out, and we altered our fences to suit." I remember hearing him testify as a witness to a will. It appeared that the testator was sick in bed when he signed the instrument. He was suffering greatly, and when he was to sign, it was necessary to lift him with the extremest care, to turn him to the light stand. "State what was done next," the lawyer asked of James. "Captain Frost was laying on his left side," said James. "Two of us took a hold of him and rolled him over." He had probably not the least suspicion that his language had a maritime flavor. I asked him one night, as we coasted along toward home, "What do seafaring men call the track of light that the moon makes on the water?" "They must have some name for it." "No, no," he said, "they don't have no name for it, they just call it the wake of the moon." James's learning had been chiefly gained from the outside world and not from books. I have heard him lay it down as a fact that the word Bible had its etymology from the word Bible, handbill. It was writ, he said, in small parcels, and they was passed around by them that writ 'em, like by bills, and so when they hove it all into one, they called it the Bible. But while James had little learning himself, he appreciated it highly in others. I had occasion to ask him once why it was that the son of one of his neighbors, in closing up his father's estate, had not settled his accounts regularly in the probate court. "Oh, I know how that was," he replied, "he settled 'em the other way. You see, he went to the college at Woonsocket, and he learned there how to settle accounts the other way, and that's the way he settled them. And then he added, when Alvin left the college, they give him a book that tells how to do all kinds of business, and what you want to do so's to make money, and Alvin has always followed them rules. The consequence is, he's made money, and what he's made, he's kept it. I suppose he's worth not less than $1,600. Sometimes he would venture a remark of a gallant nature. They don't generally get the lights in the hall so as to suit me, he once said. I don't want it too light, because then it hurts my eyes, but I want it light enough so as to I can see the women. James was a large, strong man, but Mrs. Parsons, although she was little and slight, and was always ailing, constantly assumed the role of her husband's nurse and protector, not only in household matters, but in other affairs of life. Whenever she had visitors, and she and James were hospitable in the extreme, she was pretty sure to end up, sooner or later, if James were present, with some droll criticism of him, as much to his delight as to hers. James sometimes liked to affect a certain harshness of demeanor, but the disguise was a transparent one. How well do I remember the time, oh, so long ago, when for some reason or other I happened to have his boat instead of my own, one day, with one of the boys of the village, to go to Matamet, 12 miles off, to visit certain lobster pots which we had set. We were delayed there by breaking our boom, in jibing. We should have been at home at noon, at 7 in the evening we were not yet in sight. When we got in, rather crestfallen at our disaster, particularly as the boat was wanted for the next day, James met us at the pier. We were boys then, and his tongue was free. As he stood there on the shore, bareheaded, hastily summoned from his house, with his hair blowing in the wind, waving his hands and addressing first us and then a knot of men who stood smoking by, no words of censure were too harsh, no comment on our carelessness too cutting, no laments too keen over the irreparable loss of that particular boom. The next time I could take my own boat, if I were going to get cast away. And I remember well how he ended his tirade. I didn't care nothing about you two, he said. If you want to get drowned, it ain't nothing to me. All I was afraid of was that you'd gone and capsized my boat, and wouldn't never turn up to tell where you sunk her. But as for you, and he laughed a laugh of heartless indifference. But 10 minutes later, and right before his face, at his own front gate, Mrs. Parsons betrayed him. I never see father so worried, she said, since the time he heard about Thomas. Why, he's spent the whole afternoon as nervous as a hawk, going up on the hill with his spyglass, and I don't feel so sure but what he was crying. He said he didn't care nothing about the boat, what's that old boat? Says he, but if you boys was drowned out of her, he wouldn't never get over it. At which James, being so unmasked, laughed in a shamefaced way, and shook us by the shoulders. He had a son who carried on some sort of half-maritime business on one of the wharves, in the city, and lived over his shop. When James went at intervals to visit him, he made his way at once from the railway station.